Is anonymity a right we should demand when it comes to speaking online? Or is the ability to speak from behind a mask merely a privilege we take for granted? We'll explore the anonymous and more on this week's Radio Berkman. Forum posters and commenters the world wide web over employ the power of the anonymous pen to utter the most seditious of their internal thoughts without fear of repercussion. However, repercussions do occur, and a flood of defamation cases against anonymous web scribes might give us the impression that the web is nothing more than a glorified bathroom wall, a blank slate for bloggers to tar others with the most pernicious of epithets and permanently damage reputations. Well, the victims of defamation from the ubiquitous anonymous have had enough and are fighting back. All over the country and the world, the allegedly defamed are using the threat of legal action, not just against the anonymous scribes themselves, but against those who might shield IP addresses, email addresses, and other digital fingerprints of the anonymous. With new cases in the news every week, one might think anonymity is under threat. Some blog hosts out there like Google, who operates Blogger.com, or perhaps the Supreme Court will just declare one day, okay, enough is enough. No more going incognito. If someone's going to call someone else a skank, they have to put their name on that comment. Well, we have to take into account that not all anonymous speech is equally heinous. After all, one person's bathroom wall graffiti is another person's Federalist Papers. How is society dealing with anonymous speech as it makes its way from cyberspace to the real world and into the courts? To shed some light on this, we talked to Sam Bayard, a fellow at the Berkman Center and assistant director of the Citizen Media Law Project. He's been following anonymity in cyberspace for some time and catches us up with some of the cases, recent and historic, that inform our current perspectives.
I became aware of this case back in January of this year, but it goes back even a bit further. It's an anonymous individual created a blog of sorts on Google's Blogger service, and the title of the blog was Skanks in NYC. In fact, it just focused on this one individual, the model. I believe she's Canadian, Liskula Cohen, and it said things like, she's a skank, she's skanky, she's a hoe, or she's acting like a hoe, and referred to her as like a psychotic, whoring, lying skank. There are also a series of photographs. So somehow whoever created this blog had gone out and found photos of Ms. Cohen and some of her friends. Appears that they were at a party. Some of them are what you would call sexually suggestive position, not in a hardcore sense, but they're sort of, you know, horsing around at a party, sexualized gestures, and their captions. So a lot of the text of the blog is written as captions to these photos.
Okay, to me this sounds sort of like your typical Perez Hilton style celebrity blogging. What sets this apart?
One of the things that sets this apart is it's not whereas Perez Hilton sort of trash talks or says nasty things about celebrities in the course of reporting on, you know, events that are taking place, and he's got a somewhat legitimate sort of journalistic gig going on. This was, you know, dedicated to basically saying terrible things about one individual. It's only got five posts on it. It's just about Cohen.
And let's get into the case of the person behind the blog. This person signed up on Blogger for a free account, and there's no name registered on it. Supposedly, they're anonymous for all intents and purposes. What happened in the case with Ms. Cohen that caused them to unveil this person's identity?
Ms. Cohen filed something called a petition for pre-action discovery in a New York state court. You file a piece of paper essentially that says, I want to bring a defamation lawsuit against this anonymous individual, but I don't know who this individual is, so I need information first. And what she does is she named Google as sort of the object of this petition. Mm-hmm. It's not that she's suing Google. It's simply sort of a mechanism to get information from Google. Nowadays, it's very common for Google and others to say, we're not going to turn over your private information, your identity, anything of this sort without a court order. The plaintiffs will, in these types of cases, will often go to Google and say, hey, you know, I think I've been wronged. Give me the identity of so-and-so blogger or so-and-so Gmail account. But Google said, no, no, you know, we have a specific policy on this. We're not going to give you that information without a court order.
Before they've determined that this person did anything wrong, they have to find out who this person is and then charge the person.
Yeah, kind of. So the courts impose certain procedural safeguards on this question of whether or not to turn over an anonymous speaker's identity. And the reason they do this is because a number of courts now have started to recognize that there is, in some sense, a First Amendment right to engage in anonymous speech. It's thought of more as a sort of qualified privilege. Assuming you are anonymous, you're speaking anonymously, if you haven't done anything wrong or illegal, the legal process shouldn't unmask you without proper justification. And the heart of this proper justification is this plaintiff, or this would-be plaintiff, do they have a good case against you? Have you committed, you know, the most common example, like the Cohen case, is have you committed defamation? Because the Supreme Court has said, you know, defamatory speech is not protected by the First Amendment. So whether you're anonymous or not, you can't hide behind the First Amendment if you're committing defamation. Can we decide at this early threshold, this early point in the case, you know, in Cohen's case, before the lawsuit even starts, really, whether or not there's a good claim, good defamation claim? And that's sort of what this whole Cohen case was about.
Okay, I want to get into the issue of whether anonymity is a cardinal value that we want to protect. But before we get into that, I wanted to go back and look at the history of these kinds of cases, because it seems like these cases have been coming up more and more lately. Is that an accurate assessment? Like I don't know if it's just because I'm more attuned to it, or if it's actually, you know, there's a lot more lawsuits about anonymity in the world of blogging.
It certainly seems like just since the Cohen case sort of got in the news, every time you turn around, the issue is up again, is up again in some other context. I've been looking at this issue since I came to the Berkman Center in the summer of 2007. At first, it was, I would say, a trickle of cases involving this issue. And I kind of watched them as they would come along, and I'd write about them on our blog, and we'd put them in our legal threats database. My sense is now it's much harder to even keep up with this issue as it's coming up so often. For example, just since the Cohen thing has happened, I found a case in California that involves this blog called The People's Vanguard of Davis, and it's operated by an individual named David Greenwald. Apparently, Mr. Greenwald's received a subpoena seeking the identity of a number of anonymous commenters to his blog.
Okay, wait. So it's not only a matter of being an anonymous blogger. Like, if I start up a blog with no trace of my name or anything, yeah. You're saying that you can be challenged just for posting a comment on a blog?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I'd say it comes up much more commonly in the context of commenters on somebody else's blog or on a news site. Some guy runs a blog about Davis, and he reported on a lawsuit that's going on between a former employee of the university and the university, and some people left some comments. And then the plaintiff in that lawsuit says, oh, I think that's relevant to my case. I want to know who those people are. So sends a subpoena to the blog operator, and he challenges it. He's I'm not going to turn it over. Another thing just since the Cohen case came forward is there was a ruling in a previous New York case. There was a former congressman, Richard Oettinger, and his wife. They were seeking the identity of various commenters to I think it was a forum site that was run by a newspaper, which is the Journal News. And so they were seeking the identity of these commenters who had posted on the forum saying the Oettingers were renovating their home, and there was all sorts of controversy in the community about whether these renovations were good with the zoning laws and whatnot. And so back in June 2008, a New York state court turned over that information. I believe the individual's name was Stuart Tekert. And so the Oettingers then filed a lawsuit against him. And so just a few weeks ago, the court in that defamation lawsuit dismissed the lawsuit against Mr. Tekert, even though he had been unmasked previously The court found that the Oettinger's case against him wasn't strong enough to even make it to trial, so dismissed the case.
You also highlighted a Canadian case that happened earlier this week.
There was a case just this week, or just came into the press this week. York University, I believe it's in Toronto, they got court orders requiring Google and two Canadian ISPs to turn over the identities of the authors of certain emails circulated to the faculty of the university, saying extremely critical things about the school's president. Again, the issue of what you do online being discoverable through the legal process. We looked at another Canadian case in, say, March 2009, a human rights lawyer from Canada, Richard Warman. He's well known for bringing lawsuits against these sort of right-wing neo-Nazi groups. He brings sort of human rights complaints against them, saying that they're engaging in hate speech on the internet. So there's this right-wing website, Free Dominion, and apparently either the operators of the site or some anonymous commenters on that site said some mean things about Mr. Warman, accused him of trying to censor the internet. And so he turns around and sues them for defamation, sought through the legal process to obtain the identities of these anonymous commenters. And the court divulged the identities of the commenters. The interesting thing about the Canadian case is that the reasoning of that court was quite different from the reasoning that you see on this issue in the U.S. courts. And so in the U.S. courts, like I was saying earlier, it often involves a sort of balancing of First Amendment rights. This one Canadian court looked at the issue more in terms of the privacy rights of the speaker.
This must be a phenomenon kind of exclusive to this era that we're in right now. The idea of anonymity and free expression being so easy to engage in over the web, all the forums moving to the web and being able to post without having to divulge who you are, say anything you want. But is there any history to this before internet?
When the courts are dealing with these issues now nowadays, they actually draw on some Supreme Court precedents that hark back to the colonial era, the practice of political pamphleteering in the days before there was a mass media. What there were sort of independent individual printing presses that would print materials for you if you paid them. Anonymous pamphleteers distributing their ideas in an anonymous form, whether for fear of retaliation, fear that their ideas were unpopular or whatnot. This was a well-established practice. In 1735, John Peter Zenger published a series of materials, they may have been pamphlets, that were extremely critical of the what's called the Crown Governor of New York. The governor goes to Zenger and tries to compel him to reveal the identity of the authors of these materials. And Zenger refused. The governor turned around and prosecuted Zenger for what's known as seditious libel. This is a criminal form of defamation. A jury actually acquits him. But an interesting point about this case was something that one of the justices of the Supreme Court noted in a 1995 case on the right to speak anonymously. Justice Thomas noted about this case that it also sort of shows at an early moment in our history the extent to which anonymity was tied up with freedom of the press. Another really important example is the founding fathers, or a subset of them. I mean, we're talking about the people that drafted the Constitution. James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay published what are known as the Federalist Papers under a pseudonym, Publius, in order to focus the audience's attention on the merits of their arguments rather than on their status as sort of prominent politicians or members of this Federalist Party. And essentially what's in the Federalist Papers are arguments for why we should adopt the U.S. Constitution. Right? So there's this really strong pedigree in U.S. history for this idea of anonymous speech.
This is probably an illogical argument, but I feel I would be remiss to not draw attention to the comparison between the merits of the anonymity in the the cases of the early part of the American history and today's anonymous commenting, one is one of political repression and attempting secure your rights, and one being one of writing on the bathroom wall of the local club.
And this is one of the real sort of tensions that sort of underlie how you address this issue today. Because, yeah, I mean, if you start making qualitative evaluations of the merits of the speech or the importance of the speech, the modern speech doesn't measure up too well. But it's important to remember the benefits of anonymous speech. They go beyond this sort of bathroom wall speech. It provides this medium for those with unpopular ideas, those that fear retaliation to give expression to their some marginal voices. We may not always agree with the output, and we may not even think the output's very important, but the sort of opportunity to engage in anonymous speech itself, I would say, does have some value. Certainly, there are things you could say on the internet that would get you sent to jail. There are a lot of things you can say on the internet that'll get you sued and potentially have to pay damages. So that's sort of the most base reason for wanting to remain anonymous. It's not a terribly legitimate rationale for anonymity to say, I want to avoid the legal consequences of my actions, right? You would hope that the rationale is rather that individuals want to engage in fully constitutionally protected speech, in political activism, consumer awareness type activities. They want to, they just want to express themselves, and they're not violating any criminal laws. And they simply want to express themselves without disclosing their identity. Maybe they fear retaliation by an employer. They're a whistleblower. Maybe they live in a very small community and they want to express controversial opinions, controversial political opinions. Maybe they want to talk about very sensitive topics, sexual orientation. Lots of reasons that people might want to engage in anonymous speech.
Well, so Dan Gilmore, who's one of the more prolific bloggers on this subject, was quoted after the Cohen case challenging the merits of anonymity online by saying, and I quote, "People who don't stand behind their words deserve in almost every case no respect for what they say. When you read or hear an anonymous or pseudonymous attack on someone else, you should not just assume that it's false. Assume that the accuser is an outright contemptible liar."
Yeah, no, I mean, and I actually agree with Dan. I agree with Dan's point that as a matter of credibility, right? Dan's talking about this from the perspective, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think he's looking at this primarily from the perspective of sort of journalistic credibility, for one. So, and his point is clearly a good one when it comes to journalistic credibility. We're not going to take the words of an anonymous speaker, we're not going to invest them with the sort of credibility we would of the same speech that someone would attach their name to, is that you put your name to it, you stand behind it, it lends it a bit of credibility. If you're not willing to put your name on it, there are good reasons to suspect maybe it's because there's something not credible about the speech. Of course, there could be other reasons, but Dan's saying, as a default rule, you should assume the person doesn't want to disclose their name because they're a liar. As a society evaluating speech that we see on the internet, it's probably best for us to start off with this sort of negative credibility assessment when it comes to anonymous speech. Now, if the anonymous speaker can give us a good reason to trust them, if someone's writing in an iterative fashion, you see post after post after post, and you start to see, wow, this is really quality work here. There's a lot of facts here, and the facts match up with what I know from other sources, and wow, they're relying on reputable reports or whatnot. You could start to develop a sense of trust for an anonymous speaker.
So it seems what Dan is suggesting through your lens is a third way, perhaps born out of frustration with these cases and the back and forth, that might be one of media literacy that we should just not necessarily dismiss these people outright, but if there's an anonymous person throwing a comment out there that they don't have any reason to not want to pair up with their identity, that we start out with a negative credibility. And then we could say the same in this Liscula Cohen case. We could say the same in the case of, I believe it was a Harvard law student who's...
I think you're thinking of the Yale law student case. So the auto admit case was another situation where this came into the national spotlight. These two Yale law students were sort of subject to terrible, harassing, abusive comments on this forum site called AutoAdmit. And they're in the process right now of a lawsuit, and have managed to uncover the identities of a few of these speakers. And
well, in that case, I believe the plaintiff was rejected. Her claim was that she was rejected from something, I think, like 39 potential internships or jobs.
Yeah, she had trouble getting summer.
The Google searches resulting from her name. And in this case, maybe we're saying, you know, rather than take it to court, that the blame lays a little bit on those firms that rejected her because gave credibility to these Google search results.
Well, I mean, we should have more sophistication in how we interact with anonymous speech, right? I mean, if you see someone that posts writing on the bathroom wall, you should evaluate it for what it is. And it's theoretically fine to say, well, those law firms should have done it differently. I think Dan's point is a good one. It may take a generation, right? This is the kind of thing that's going to take educating a whole generation of people, or people growing up with the internet, growing up with this kind of anonymous speech, growing up with this kind of trash talking, to become inured to it. And be like, look, this is just part of life. We're all going to have some terrible stuff about us somewhere on the internet. We're going to have to learn to simply live with it, because the internet makes it cheap, makes it easy for whoever's got an axe to grind to throw something up. Certainly, I do think it's going to take some time. And in the interim, it's hard to imagine people aren't going to pursue legal avenues.
Sam Bayard, that's his real name, not just a pseudonym, is a fellow at the Berkman Center and assistant director of the Citizen Media Law Project. You can find out more about some of the cases Sam talked about by visiting our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. You can also share your perspectives with us, anonymously or not, in the comment section. Radio Berkman is produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge.